Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, thanks for joining us for this episode of New Books in Philosophy. I'm Robert Talese. I'm professor of philosophy at Vanderbilt University, and I co-host the program with Carrie Figger. Carrie is associate professor of philosophy at the University of Iowa. My guest today is David Rondeau. David is assistant professor of philosophy at the University of Nevada, Reno. He is a social and political philosopher whose work is centrally engaged with the idiom of American pragmatism. David's new book is titled Pragmatist Egalitarianism, and it's published by Oxford University Press. Pragmatism is a longstanding philosophical idiom that advocates public-facing philosophy, that is, philosophy which abandons the long tradition of academic puzzles and addresses itself to the social and political problems of our day. This commitment is perhaps most firmly manifest in the case of John Dewey. Unsurprisingly, Dewey wrote extensively in social and political philosophy, focusing in particular on developing a conception of participatory democracy. Now, given Dewey's strong commitment to democracy, it's clear that Dewey is some kind of egalitarian. But what's also surprising is that Dewey wrote little that's explicitly about justice. Now, in his book, David Rondeau seeks to make explicit pragmatism's contribution to egalitarian political philosophy. Drawing specifically on Dewey, James, and Richard Rorty, Rondeau argues for a pluralist approach to egalitarianism, one that resolves tensions among competing versions of egalitarianism. As usual, there's a lot to talk about, but also as usual, we'll begin with our guest. Hello, David.
Hello, Bob.
How are you today?
I'm very well. How about you?
Oh, doing great. Why don't you start us off, as we normally do start off, by telling us a little bit about yourself?
I would love to. And thank you, Bob, for having me on the program here.
It's my pleasure.
As you mentioned in your brief introductory remarks, I'm an assistant professor in philosophy at the University of Nevada, which is in Reno. As you said as well, I work mainly in political philosophy and legal philosophy. And I also have strong research interests in the American pragmatist tradition, particularly in the work of William James, John Dewey, and Richard Rorty. So, okay, a bit about me. I'm 40 years old. I was born and raised in Toronto, Canada. My path into philosophy, it isn't a particularly interesting story. I don't think. Basically, philosophy 101 was the course that I enjoyed the most out of the five or six courses that I took in my freshman year in college at the University of Western Ontario in London, Ontario. And pretty much on that basis alone, I decided to become a philosophy major. To be honest with you, I'm not sure what it was that captivated me about philosophy. As a teenager, I had a sort of dark, brooding temperament. I consumed a lot of music like Nirvana, Nine Inch Nails, and other sort of angsty bands from the early to mid-1990s. But I was also at that time, in sort of my young teenage years, drawn to existentialist ideas, particularly in the form that they take in some novels. So Dostoevsky and Albert Camus were sort of chief among my favorites at that time. So, I'm not really sure, but I have a feeling that, or it's plausible at any rate, that studying philosophy may have somehow, you know, satisfied those same brooding proclivities that I had had as a teenager. But I'm just speculating as to why philosophy may have caught on for me. As for how I eventually became interested in political philosophy in particular, I think that some of that is explained by my parents. So my parents are both immigrants to Canada. My mother from the French-speaking part of Belgium, she's from a city called Liège, which is in the sort of area of Wallonia, the French part of Belgium. And my father is Israeli. He's the son of German Jews who fled Hitler in the 1930s. And my parents actually met on an Israeli kibbutz. For your listeners who may not be familiar with an Israeli kibbutz, it's a kind of propertyless socialist farm slash commune. And so, that's where my parents met. And so there was a certain, I guess, leftist orientation there from the beginning. I wouldn't characterize my parents as politically radical, but nonetheless, I think a certain kind of leftist politics, or social democratic politics is probably more accurate, pervaded the household that I grew up in. So there would be regular discussions about political issues around the dinner table in my house growing up. And I'm sure that had something to do with that helped to foster my interest in political philosophy, I'm sure.
Well, fabulous. Can I ask just a quick question out of curiosity before you continue, if you choose to? So do you have any speculations about how the angsty brooding temperament was attracted to pragmatism, which is on some readings, I don't think the most accurate ones I should add, is very positive about the future?
You're absolutely right. You know, I think unlike other pragmatists, maybe of an older generation, what really drew me into pragmatism actually was Richard Rorty's work. And it's sort of through Rorty that I kind of in reverse discovered Peirce, James, and Dewey. And Rorty, I think Rorty is kind of angsty. There's definitely a hopefulness that runs through his work without question. But you know, he's very critical. He's repeatedly telling his readers, you know, what's a waste of time and what's turned out to be a dead end, and you know. Which dualism or controversy is sort of no longer really worth thinking about. So I think there is some of that temperament in maybe most of all in Rorty, but you're right. I mean, the pragmatists are a hopeful bunch by and large. It's a good point.
Did you come to pragmatism in the course of your graduate study, or was that something that you picked up somewhere before you entered graduate school in philosophy?
That's right. So, you know, American pragmatism was not covered at all, really, in my undergraduate education. I recall that in my senior year, I took an epistemology seminar, at which points pieces from Richard Rorty's 1979 book, Philosophy in the Mirror of Nature, came up. And I got sort of really captivated by what Rorty was doing in that book. And I think sort of the discovery of Rorty is what really propelled me onwards to graduate school. So I went to do a master's degree at Concordia University in Montreal, where I was supervised by a philosopher named Kai Nielsen, who has sort of strong affinities with the pragmatist tradition. And subsequent to that, I did my doctoral work at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario, where my work was supervised by Barry Allen, who was actually a student of Rorty's at Princeton a number of years earlier. So, I guess I got a little taste of Rortian pragmatism in particular at the very sort of tail end of my undergraduate education, and that's what maybe spurred me onwards.
Oh, fabulous. Is it okay to start talking about the book? Would that be a good idea?
Absolutely. Yes, let's do it.
Great. Your book is titled A Pragmatist Egalitarianism, and it enters the fray of what many readers, I'm sure, will recognize as a long-standing debate within the very large literature that has accumulated about justice. And more generally, your book is entering a series of debates within a particular group of justice theorists, namely the egalitarians. These are the folks who contend that justice requires that something be made to be equal, or be made equal. And I guess many listeners will know that these debates have their origin in the publication of Rawls's The Theory of Justice and other things that were going on in the early 70s. But for those who might need a refresher or who aren't familiar, maybe one place to begin is with some of the background that the book picks up with. So maybe begin with telling us some very broad descriptions of the background and the debates about egalitarianism that your book is in part trying to navigate.
Sure thing. Yes. Right. Egalitarians believe in equality. I think that much is uncontroversial. It's probably analytically true. But of course, they disagree vociferously with one another about how equality, how the ideal of equality is best understood or properly understood. So there's a well-known divide in the contemporary philosophical literature on egalitarianism between two sort of large camps of theorists or theories. One of these camps tends to think that equality understood properly is fundamentally about the equal distribution of something. This camp, of course, disagrees about what that something is, but they agree that that's the right way to pose the question about equality's value. So I think it was back in 1980, perhaps 1979, Amartya Sen, the Nobel Prize winning economist, he famously posed the question, equality of what, in the Tanner lectures that he gave in that year. And I think, you know, from there, a fairly lengthy and if I'm speaking candidly, kind of finicky debate ensued from there. So philosophers that are sort of contributing to this literature, I think in general, are asking something like, to the extent that we prize equality as a distributive goal, you know, what is it exactly that we're prizing? So otherwise put. How should we distribute goods and resources among people? What is it that they should end up equal in? What is the, to put it in G.A. Cohen's language, what is the currency of egalitarian justice? Should we distribute resources so that people end up equal in the welfare levels that they're enjoying in their lives, or that they end up equal in their opportunity to achieve welfare? Or that they end up equal perhaps in, Rawlsian primary goods or some other metric altogether. So, this is, I think, what the so-called equality of what debate is all about. And I think, at its root, it's a debate that understands the importance of equality in fundamentally distributive terms. It's about the equal distribution of something. So on the other side of this dispute, I think, are those who see the value of equality in a slightly different way. For this second group, I think what really matters, insofar as equality matters, is that people stand to one another in relations of equality, right? As opposed to, say, relations of hierarchy or relations of oppression. So on this kind of view, distributive inequality matters, no doubt, or certainly may matter. But that's only because those kinds of distributive inequalities impede or make it hard for people to stand to one another on equal terms, as equals. So I think what really matters for the second group of egalitarians is not the equal distribution of something as such, but rather the quality of human relationships, right? And so if distributive inequalities matter, that's only because of their bearing on the quality of human relationships. So this divide, I mean, I've just sort of sketched it. I think it can be spelled out in various ways. I think it's probably fairly old as a dispute. I think you're right, incidentally, that much of this goes back to the 1970s and the aftermath of John Rawls's theory of justice. But yes, I mean, whatever its sort of precise provenance, I think it was actually Elizabeth Anderson's 1999 article, What is the Point of Equality, that really made this a sort of a lively debate among contemporary political philosophers. So I guess maybe one general thing to say about the debate between these two sort of camps of egalitarians, I mean, I think what they have in common, among other things, is that they're engaged in a search for fundamentality, right? They're asking the question about, insofar as equality is valuable, you know, what is the ideal or conception of equality that fundamentally accounts for this value? And I should say, maybe to sort of segue forward here, that one major impetus for the book that I wrote is that it seemed to me fairly early on that the main question around which this debate revolves, which I take to be the question, what is the fundamentally important egalitarian ideal? Is it a distributive ideal, or is it kind of a relational or democratic ideal? It seemed to me that was sort of a badly formed question, or maybe the wrong question to be asking. So yeah, it seemed to me that people who cared about equality, egalitarians, were being forced to choose between two, I guess what seemed to me somewhat artificial options. And perhaps I'd mention, most of the people that I know who care about equality, certainly those who aren't philosophers, tend to think that, if they consider the question at all, that equality, the value of equality can't be boiled down to one fundamental commitment or one fundamental set of principles, the way that this debate between sort of distributive and relational egalitarians sometimes, I think, seems to assume. So anyhow, that's, I guess, some of the background about egalitarianism that maybe helps set the stage for what I try to do in the book.
Yeah, fabulous. That's very helpful. So let's get into the book. One of the sort of stage setting moves that you make that I think is particularly helpful and useful is that you sort of divide up the various egalitarian views, or we might say the sort of the egalitarian terrain, into distinct sort of views about what we might think of sort of like the way to conceptualize equality, no matter what we think the currency may be. And you call you separate these into two different views with the labels vertical and horizontal. Tell us a little bit about how that pair of categories helps us to start seeing where some of the fault lines are in our thinking about equality.
Sure. So I use these sort of broad headings, these labels, vertical egalitarianism and horizontal egalitarianism, to distinguish between sort of two very broad, amorphous sometimes conceptions of equality. So I mean, these headings, vertical and horizontal, have a lot of content packed into them. But I introduced them, as you said, really just to help pick out some large types within egalitarian theory, or the across the egalitarian terrain, I think, as you put it. So yeah, the goal here is to kind of stick organizational tags on different kinds of theories and sort of help us see better some of the prevailing contrasts and disputes among contemporary egalitarians. So, I mean, very roughly, the vertical metaphor is intended to evoke, the vertical relationship between state and citizen, whereas the horizontal metaphor is intended to evoke the kind of social relationship between or among citizens. So, you know, whereas the vertical image kind of has us imagining an impartial state, right, distributing to each citizen the rights and resources to which they're justly entitled, the horizontal image, by contrast, has us imagining something perhaps like an idealized town hall meeting or maybe a camping trip. It was the metaphor that G.A. Cohen uses in his book about socialism. But at any rate, it has us imagining something like an egalitarian community, right, in which people stand to one another in relations of equality. So I mean, clearly, I introduced the vertical and horizontal distinction to help sort of track the distributive relational distinction that I spoke about a moment ago, and also sort of to maybe gather under the same ambit, a number of similar distinctions in the same neighborhood. For example, like the distinction between redistribution and recognition that was made famous by Nancy Fraser. That's one sort of use of the vertical horizontal labels. But I also want to use those labels in a wider way in the book to sort of track other issues, mainly methodological and metaphilosophical issues, I think, that egalitarian philosophers tend to disagree about. So as I put it forward, the distinction also loosely maps onto the dispute between those egalitarians who tend to think that the egalitarian ideal can be made precise, can be spelled out with clear and definitive principles, versus those on the other side who don't think that's in the offing. And I also use the distinction to track the sort of the difference between those who think that the egalitarian ideal can be realized in sort of a final and whole way versus those who tend to see egalitarianism as an interminable project, something that's sort of forever a work in progress, as it were. A lot of this is a bit artificial, I'll grant. But I do make explicit in the book that these aren't advanced as sort of perfect oppositions. In fact, any egalitarian theory that's worth taking seriously will almost certainly feature both vertical and horizontal elements. And of course, they'll combine these elements in different ways. I say in the book, in fact, that vertical and horizontal egalitarianism are akin to Max Weber's ideal types. So, you know, they don't really exist out there in the world. But nevertheless, I think they're sort of useful categories for, you know, helping to fix ideas and helping us to see, I guess, in a clearer way, what the egalitarian terrain looks like from, 20,000 feet, as it were. Yes, I think, for purposes of the main argument of the book, the distinction between vertical and horizontal egalitarianism is, I think, basically coextensive with the distributive versus relational divide among egalitarians that I spoke about a moment ago. But as I said, I did want a set of terms that captured other important differences between egalitarian theorists, as opposed to just that single area of disagreement.
Right. And it's good to have emphasized in the book and emphasize here that, in lots of actual cases, lots of actual egalitarian theories, the vertical and the horizontal categorizations are kind of combined in various ways. So G.A. Cohen is a distributive egalitarian, but he's interested not merely in the relationship between citizens and the basic structure of their society or their state, but rather the transactions that occur between citizens as such. So it looks as if he's a distributive egalitarian with a sort of horizontal orientation. Does that sound like it might be right?
I think that's quite right. Yes. Yeah, so G.A. Cohen is definitely on the sort of distributive side. I mean, he's a major contributor to that equality of what literature that I spoke about a little while ago. But yes, when it comes to the question about the site of distributive justice, so the question, not sort of what are the correct principles, but to whom do they apply or to whom or what do they apply? Cohen does emphasize that there are duties of egalitarian justice that obtain between between individuals, in addition, of course, to those principles applying to the basic structure of society. So that's right. I mean, I think Cohen's work gives us a good example of the various ways that the different elements that comprise these sort of two broad categories, vertical and horizontal, can be combined in various ways.
Great. Can I ask one more question about this? It's a little bit broader than the material in the book. So I'm just wondering now whether you think in cases where we're thinking about theories of justice, both in the domestic case and in the cosmopolitan cases, the international cases, global cases, whether a single theorist could have a vertical view of the orientation, as we might call it, of justice in the domestic case, or sorry, got that wrong. I wonder if it makes sense to think that maybe a theorist could have a vertical view of justice in the global context and a horizontal view in the domestic context, because I imagine that for theories of global justice, a horizontal view is going to be strained in various ways, because it's justice among people who are essentially strangers and separated by great distance of geography and other kinds of distance, right?
That sounds right to me. I mean, I think the possibility that you just sketched certainly exists in conceptual space.
But that's not saying a lot.
I just can't think of a theorist or a philosopher off the top of my head who endorses something like that. But I guess it would certainly be possible. Is there someone you had in mind that?
No, just as you were describing it, I was just thinking like, well, you know, some theorists think that it's a virtue of a conception of egalitarian justice that it gives a unified account in the domestic and the global contexts. Others think that Rawls and people who follow him very closely, I guess, think that justice in the sense that justice is fairness is supposed to be tracking can't be a global thing. It can only be a domestic thing because it's tied to the basic structure of a particular society. And so maybe they think justice is not the right evaluative term to talk about global distributive questions. There's a metaphilosophical question there about whether we want a unified account of the domestic and the global sense, or if we could, as your categories might suggest we could, think of justice vertically for global justice purposes and think of justice horizontally for domestic cases.
Yeah, no, I think it's certainly a possibility. My sense is that a large portion of global justice theorists tend to end up endorsing something closer to sort of sufficientarianism at the global level, as opposed to egalitarianism as such. But I mean, I think it's a very interesting sort of proposal to think about how these questions and my categories in particular sort of translate or map onto debates about global justice as opposed to domestic justice. It's actually not really an area that I take up in at all in the book. So it is maybe something to think about going forward, if I could extend the account now.
Well, cool. Let's get back to what's in the book. Does that sound okay? you also sort of in your analysis, after you set out these two broad categories of vertical and horizontal as ways of sort of separating out different kinds of approaches to egalitarian justice, you also see within egalitarianism three distinct what you call variables. And you give them names, the institutional variable, the personal variable, sometimes also called the individual variable, and the cultural. And you think that equality and the egalitarian ideal has what we might think of as three different faces or three different contexts associated with these variables. Can you tell us a little bit about how that part of the argument shakes out?
Absolutely, yeah. I identify philosophically speaking with the tradition of American pragmatism. I think that's the case for you as well, Bob. I understand, yes. And I think part of what I wanted to explore in my book is the question, what does this debate between distributive and relational egalitarians, or vertical and horizontal egalitarians, if you like. What does it look like if it were it to be pursued from a pragmatist point of view? So the three variables that you just asked about, I think, are sort of connected with that. So if it's all right, maybe I'll say something brief about pragmatism to help sort of contextualize what I was trying to do. Pragmatists, as I sort of read them, believe, I think uniformly, that inquiry, thinking, philosophical reflection is occasioned by problems, what John Dewey called problematic situations. So a problem for these purposes is really, I think, just anything that unsettles the normal flow of experience, anything that disrupts the smooth, right, unhabitual flow of things in some way. So, you know, one, I think, useful example of this kind of problem-centric slant, definitive of pragmatism, comes from the pragmatism's founder, Charles Sanders Peirce, and his repudiation of Cartesian skepticism. So in the famous 1877 essay, The Fixation of Belief, Peirce calls Cartesian skeptical doubts make-believe doubts. I think elsewhere in that paper he calls them paper doubts. Real doubt, genuine doubt, on the other hand, Peirce argued, is like a kind of irritation, right? It unsettles us in some way. It disrupts the normal sort of unreflective, smooth state of belief. And of course, as you know, for Peirce, inquiry is the name of the process by which we try to soothe the irritating state of doubt by regaining the non-irritating and comfortable state of belief. So I think Peirce says somewhere that genuine doubt, as opposed to make-believe Cartesian doubt, is too distressing a state to pass over us unrecognized. And I think, you know, the same general thought is true for all problems, sort of just more generally. When experience, when life is flowing smoothly, we don't really need to think or inquire or theorize. But when something happens to make experience flow less smoothly, when something irritates us, when a problem impinges, so to speak, that's when thinking and inquiry and philosophical reflection are called for. That's when they begin. And so, you know, anyway, that's a very loose sketch, I think, of a central pragmatist insight. But I think taking that kind of problem-centric slant definitive of pragmatism seriously, I think that has some important implications for thinking about equality in particular, and perhaps also for political theory more broadly. So as I see things, putting problems first, so to speak, seems to me to go hand in hand with some species of political realism. So on this kind of view, egalitarian philosophers need to be attentive to historical, sociological, and political facts. I think a corollary is that you know, we don't learn much about equality just from disinterested contemplation or just from, you know, a priori armchair theorizing. On this kind of political realist view that I think sort of follows from pragmatism, we need to sort of attend to and take seriously the messy world of real politics. So I think in general, this kind of approach will be suspicious about the project of trying to formulate sort of timeless principles in ideal theory, you know, principles from which everything else can kind of be deduced and so on. A related point, or maybe just another way to make the same point, is that this kind of approach, this sort of pragmatist, problem-centric, politically realist approach, will again take seriously, or it'll assign a certain precedence to struggles for equality in the real world, movements and struggles in the real world. So again, I think this is part of the same general distrust of a priori theorizing that I think runs through the pragmatist tradition. And, you know, the upshot is that we can't figure out, you know, what equality requires or how best to conceive of equality just by speculating from the philosopher's armchair. We need to attend to the real world. We need to take seriously the claims and complaints that are made by real people who are actually struggling for equality. And I guess a corollary to that, we need to be mindful of history and social science and to have all of that information play some important guiding role in our thinking about equality. So, okay, from that a little sort of sketch of, that, of a pragmatist problem-centric approach in political theory, but I made the argument in the book that from the point of view of that approach, the debate between distributive and relational egalitarians, or vertical and horizontal egalitarians, if you like, shows itself to be sort of ill-formed or minimally sort of unhelpful, I think. So it's not that the distinction is sort of wrong or incorrect as far as it goes. I think the more accurate complaint is that it's incomplete. So there's a lot about equality and inequality in the real world that escapes the net of a vertical horizontal analysis. So a quick illustration. I mean, consider how incompletely and poorly the idea of what feminists call patriarchy, right, might be handled by a distributive or relational or vertical horizontal analysis. So, you know, patriarchy, I think no one undoubtedly it resides in the institutions of a society, often in ways that are sort of covert and hard to spot. But I think it also lives in everyday habits and practices and private feelings of individuals who themselves are sort of shaped by the institutions they live under and who in turn help to shape and sometimes reinforce those very institutions. Patriarchal norms, though, it's also true to say, also inhabit a space of cultural meanings, which is to say that sort of patriarchal thoughts and ideas are kind of culturally in the air, so to speak, in a way that's irreducible, I argue, to either institutions or individuals. So, I mean, that's a very quick and crude illustration, but if it's sort of even remotely on the mark, I think what it reveals is that the vertical horizontal division is too sort of crude and rough, not granular enough to capture all of the ways in which we're disposed to care about equality. So what we need, I argue, is a kind of a richer vocabulary to describe what's going on in cases like these. And so, you know, the main argument of the book really is a kind of reconceptualization or a redescription of egalitarian thinking in terms of three variables that you asked about at the outset here, the institutional, the personal or individualist variable, and the cultural variable. So in other words, you know, rather than trying to settle the debate between relational and distributive egalitarians on its own terms, what I'm suggesting is that we sort of more or less change the topic, that we sort of redescribe the situation and introduce some new categories and terms. So very briefly, the three variables. The institutional variable has to do with the significance for egalitarianism of social institutions, laws, economic arrangements. The personal or individualist variable concerns the significance for egalitarianism of private individuals, private beliefs, biases, individual behavior and choices. And finally, the cultural variable has to do with the importance of culture, language, social meaning, stigma, and so on for the sort of the significance of egalitarianism as well. So, these three variables as I intend them, are both descriptive and prescriptive. So I think, you know, when we think about real world struggles for equality, almost invariably they involve some mixture of, right, the institutional, the individual, and the cultural. So I think they describe, to some degree of accuracy at least, what egalitarian struggles are actually like. But I also put them forward in the spirit of what Sally Haslanger has called an ameliorative project, which is to say that they prescribe not only how equality sort of is usually thought about or conceptualized, but how it would be best thought about and conceptualized. And so a major move in the argument is that, no one of the three variables can be reduced or subsumed by any of the others. And I also make the case that the variables are typically reinforcing and triangulated. And by triangulated, I mean that in the context of trying to understand egalitarian movements and ideals, almost always to invoke one of those variables is simultaneously to invoke the other two, even if that isn't really explicit. So, yeah, that's what I was thinking in general about these sort of the three variables, the institutional, personal, and cultural.
Fabulous. So you explicate each of these three by looking at an exemplar for each. And in the book, the three exemplars are three very prominent pragmatists, namely John Dewey, William James, and Richard Rorty, with Dewey being our guide for the institutional variable, James for the personal variable, and Rorty for the cultural. Could you run us through that part of the book?
Absolutely, yes. So as you said, I do sort of yoke each variable to one of a trio of pragmatists. Dewey is sort of my exemplar of the institutional variable, James of the personal or individualist variable, and Rorty, the exemplar of the cultural variable. It's certainly not my argument in the book that Dewey, James, and Rorty are sort of alone in stressing what they do. I think I could have written a different book in which three different thinkers could have served as exemplars of each of the variables. I mean, I might have had a book where, Rawls was kind of the institutional person, and maybe John Stuart Mill could have been someone who accentuates the individualist or personal variable, and maybe someone like Michel Foucault could have stood in as the exemplar of the cultural variable. So yes, other thinkers and figures can certainly be fitted into this rubric, I think. But it is, I think, nevertheless, a curious and interesting fact about American pragmatism that three really prominent and large figures in that tradition sort of typify, I think, so well these three different variables. So, I mean, one way to maybe get a handle on what I was arguing for is to sort of note some of the differences between James, Dewey, and Rorty, and perhaps in terms of how they conceive of the self or the individual person. So James, I think anyone who has spent some time with James will agree, I think, that he is sort of obsessed with the inward lives of individuals. Dewey, I think, has a very different emphasis in his work. He's always accentuating and emphasizing the, what he calls the associated individual. So, the individual who's, embedded in social and institutional webs, the institutional who's always going outwards into the world, as Alan Ryan nicely puts it in his biography of Dewey. So, whereas the Deweyan individual is kind of always going outward into the world and joining clubs and associating, the Jamesian individual is sort of perpetually retreating back into her private subjectivity. Rorty is interesting here, I think, because, in a way, there's a place in Rorty's thought for both of these emphases. I'd read Rorty, in fact, as kind of, one element of his philosophy is trying to find a way to split the difference between James and Dewey here. So what Rorty calls irony, private irony, looks fairly Jamesian. It enjoys affinities with that sort of Jamesian project of trying to design for oneself a significant self-authored life. Whereas the sort of the liberal solidarity stance that Rorty also defends is, I think, more Deweyan in its spirit. So, I take Rorty's argument, his famous argument in Contingency, Irony, and Solidarity, famous argument that about the sort of incommensurability of the private and the public, which has drawn a lot of criticism, incidentally. But I take the sort of main point of that argument to be that, you know, ultimately we don't, you know, we're not forced to choose between a private Jamesian self on the one hand, and a sort of public associated Deweyan self on the other. You know, properly partitioned, so to speak, these sort of two flanks of our nature don't need to get in each other's way, is sort of how I understand what I understand Rorty's argument to be. But I think, you know, beyond the sort of inner self and the sort of outer associated self, there's also in Rorty's work another important strand of thought, which probably comes to us by way of his encounter with French postmodernism. And so I'm thinking here of Rorty's emphasis on the production of social meanings, on vocabularies and you know, economies of vocabularies, and particularly on the ways that linguistic description determines or determines moral and cultural valence. So, I mean, the emphasis, I think, of all three pragmatists here is distinct, and it's kind of neat, I think, how sort of each one of these pragmatists typifies so well sort of the respective variable that I link them with. And so, you know, my argument is that all three variables, institutional, individualist, and cultural, are essential for a viable egalitarianism. If we were to sort of take each one on their own, they would be incomplete, I think. Perhaps I'll say something very briefly, if there's time, about why I kind of link each of these pragmatists with the variable that I do. So, I single out Dewey as an exemplar of the institutional variable. I mean, not because he thought institutions were sort of supremely important, you know, to the exclusion of anything else. But rather, I mean, the key thought for Dewey here, and I think the contrast with the prevailing sort of Rawlsian liberalism is significant. For Dewey, I mean, questions about the justification of various institutions should be undertaken, I think, in an experimentalist manner. So on Dewey's view, as I read him, institutions are judged not by whether or not they conform to sort of abstract principles of individual liberty or limited government, or whether they could be universally affirmed by, you know, denizens behind a veil of ignorance, but rather we judge institutions on the Deweyan view by their ability or inability to sort of reliably bring about certain concrete consequences for individuals and groups. And my argument in that chapter is that this sort of experimentalist approach to institutions lets us think of institutions instrumentally, right, as sets of tools with which to tackle specific problems. And I try to make the argument that Dewey's understanding of institutions would serve egalitarian philosophers well. James, I single out James as an exemplar of the personal variable because he seems to me to be the best spokesman for what Princeton political theorist George Kateb calls democratic individuality. And also that this sort of goes hand in hand with a kind of personal ethic of equality, right? Where sort of the focus is on individual habits and biases and things of that nature. So, you know, James had, I think, strikingly little to say about institutions. For him, institutions and laws and so on always took a backseat to the importance of the private individual. So, yes, I read James as kind of offering us a kind of personal egalitarianism, right, where we're as individuals committed to the idea that that each person's private individuality counts equally. Right. No one's private life matters more or less than anyone else's. And also I find in James sort of an endorsement of the idea that each individual should be able to flourish on his or her own terms and sort of to, a, I guess, a commitment to a set of habits and behaviors that that make this possible. I think also central in James's thought is this sort of moral imperative that he puts forward to examine ourselves for sort of moral blind spots, as it were, for ways that we might be oblivious to the frustration of others' individuality, or maybe sometimes complicit in the frustration of their individuality. And finally, I single out Richard Rorty as an exemplar of the cultural variable, in large part due to what he calls cultural politics. You'll remember, Bob, that Rorty's final collection of essays, published in 2007, bore the title Philosophy as Cultural Politics. And I think increasingly Rorty came to endorse this conception of philosophy as cultural politics. Cultural politics for Rorty involves sort of questions about what words we should use in order to best pursue our sort of long-term cultural and political hopes. And I think Rorty's political theory, particularly this emphasis on vocabularies, and especially the emphasis that he places on the social sort of transformative power of the activity of re-describing, I think all of that sort of suggests a way of thinking about equality and inequality that sort of takes seriously, as a lot of egalitarian theory does not, the importance of social meaning and culture. So yes, I think, Rorty's pragmatism is useful, for us to sort of think more intelligently about the cultural side of egalitarianism, right? About the extent to which, changes in culture and social meaning are necessarily bound up, for the realization of our, egalitarian hopes. And as I mentioned sort of, just briefly before, I mean, a crucial step in the argument here is that we need sort of the contributions of all three pragmatists here, all three variables to fill out the picture. So, taken just on their own, I think each of these pragmatists would give us a kind of a conception of equality that would be sort of incomplete and one-sided. But if you put them together, if you take them as an ensemble, I think we get the result is a pragmatist egalitarianism that's better. And by better, I guess I mean sort of descriptively and analytically more accurate, better than the picture we get from a kind of vertical, horizontal, or a distributive relational kind of analysis.
Great. So the way that you formulate at least that last point in the book is in terms of reconciliation. That is, you, at least in the book, you claim that this trio, this ensemble of egalitarian ideals represented by the exemplars that we were just talking about, not only gives us a better description or a more accurate picture or perhaps a more appropriate set of things to hope for, but as you say in the book, it actually helps to reconcile some of the divides and fissures, we might say, within the egalitarian literature. Can you tell us a little bit about that sort of reconciliationist project?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, I don't know if reconciliation is necessarily the best word to describe. It's fair because I use that word, but maybe I'll try to explain sort of what I have in mind. I mean, my sense is that if we think about equality and inequality sort of in terms of my three variables, then the question that motivates the debate between the distributive and the relational egalitarians, right, which is the question sort of, what is the fundamental egalitarian ideal? Is it a distributive ideal? Is it a relational ideal? It seems to me that question doesn't really get any obvious traction from the point of view of thinking about equality through the three variables that I described earlier. So, I have a fairly lengthy discussion towards the end of the book about racial inequality in the United States. And this is kind of a sort of a real world concrete example or illustration that is intended to kind of serve a corroborating role of the theory or of the view that I put forward. So just to sort of sketch that, I mean, relying heavily on social science data, I sort of illustrate how or you know, that, in fact, African Americans fare worse than other Americans, particularly white Americans, in virtually every sort of objective indicator of human well-being. So in health outcomes, in terms of income and wealth, education, housing, employment, crime and incarceration, and so on. And so, you know, part of the argument that I make is that, you know, coming to grips with racial inequality in the United States involves, you know, the institutional variable, the individual variable, and the cultural variable, but also, and I think this is a crucial point, the, you know, sometimes subtle, sometimes hard to spot ways in which those variables kind of work mutually together so as to reinforce and deepen inequality along racial lines. So if, you know, if someone were to be sort of serious about the about trying to understand racial inequality in the United States, clearly, you know, they would have to be attentive to a whole range of institutional questions, right? They'd have to examine the practices of, you know, institutions like banks, the criminal justice system. We'd have to look carefully at public transportation, at tax laws, urban planning and zoning policies, electoral politics would play a role in the analysis, and so on. So clearly there would be a role for the sort of institutional type of inquiry. But at the same time, it would probably involve attentiveness to private individual feelings and biases about African-American, say, you know, work ethic, violence, criminality, personal responsibility. We'd also have to pay attention to sort of nebulous, hard-to-spot cultural meanings about Black criminality, intelligence, attitude, ambition, and so on and so forth. And then sort of once we've sort of filled out all this analysis, and I think this is the crucial point, I mean, coming to grips with racial inequality in the United States would also involve understanding how the institutional, individual, and cultural variables in all of their sort of depth and richness reinforce and mutually strengthen each other, sometimes in difficult to spot ways. So, I mean, the big conclusion from the point of view of the analysis that I put forward is that, you know, inequality is never simply a problem of institutional design. It's never simply a problem that bears on sort of personal choice and bias and behavior, or it's never sort of simply a problem that depends on a kind of cultural revolution for its solution or resolution. I mean, wherever equality or inequality rather exists in the real world, it's virtually always sort of simultaneously a problem for all three of those domains, for all three of those variables. So, you know, if someone were to pose the question, you know, okay, you know, but what's the fundamental locus of racial inequality in the United States? Where does this kind of inequality sort of fundamentally at bottom reside? You know, does it reside in institutions, in private feelings, you know, hearts and minds? Or does it sort of live in sort of cultural meanings? I think the obvious answer, an answer that I think everybody basically already knows, of course, what everybody already knows doesn't always shape the way that philosophers discuss things. I think what everybody already knows is that, you know, racial inequality in the United States resides sort of equally in all three of those variables or domains. And it seems sort of far-fetched to sort of declare one of those variables causally or sort of normatively or theoretically first. So yeah, you ask about how this sort of picture, this kind of tri-variable picture offers a kind of reconciliation between distributive and relational egalitarianism. As I said, I'm not sure that reconciliation is the right word here. But I do think that thinking about equality along the lines that I suggest perhaps helps us get beyond some of the assumptions and categories that undergird the kind of relational distributive egalitarian divide. So one of the things I think that the pragmatist view that I put forward maybe helps us see, I think, is that the question that the dispute between relational and distributive egalitarian the question on which that dispute turns, right? That question, you know, which ideal is the fundamental one? It helps us see that that question, I think, is perhaps badly framed or maybe even unsound, right? The question sort of seems to suppose that, you know, insofar as we are egalitarians, insofar as we prize equality, there must be sort of some fundamental ideal that we're prizing. And I confess, I have trouble seeing why there must be some such fundamental ideal. I don't see the grounds for thinking that we need to sort of hold that to be true. I don't see why we need to think that egalitarianism has a kind of essence, right? So, you know, speaking just for myself, but I'm sure a lot of people would agree with this. I am an egalitarian. I believe in equality. I care about equality. That includes my belief in, you know, that people should receive a distribution of resources that's just and that reflects their sort of equal importance as individuals. Equally, albeit in a different way, I also believe in the value of a society in which, you know, people stand to one another as equals. But it, you know, the insistence that one of these commitments, one of these sort of conceptions must be fundamental and the other one secondary, I mean, that just strikes me as kind of perversely foundationalist, right? Sort of the upshot of a way of thinking that puts too much stock in a priori reasoning, or perhaps takes the idea of a kind of hierarchy of values too seriously. I think if we look at equality in the real world, it's not clear that sort of one of those ideals needs to come out on top as the fundamental one, and the other ideal sort of secondary and subservient to that. So, I mean, I think sort of to sum up, my claim in the book is that understanding equality in terms of the institutional, personal, and cultural variables lets us make sense, I guess, of different egalitarian movements, different egalitarian ideals, with a greater sophistication and richness than the sort that's available in a kind of vertical, horizontal analysis. I mean, I think it lets us see that, you know, some real-world struggles for equality prioritize a more just distribution of rights and resources. Other struggles, I guess, put emphasis on the promotion of more egalitarian social relationships. Still others, perhaps, place in the forefront a kind of nebulous long-term cultural transformation at their center. And of course, you know, different real world movements combine these different aims in different ways. But, you know, the result is that I think we can think about equality and inequality with a greater richness and sophistication than we could have if we just sort of theorized equality along the lines of the distributive and relational debate.
Well, David, that was fabulous. And you've been very generous with your time. We've got time left for just one final question, which I know is in some ways a cruel question to ask somebody who's just finished writing a fabulous book. What's your next project?
Yes. Okay. Well, I've got a number of, you know, smaller projects going, a sort of handful of papers on various topics in social and political philosophy ongoing. A project I'm really excited about right now is I've just signed a contract with Cambridge University Press to edit a new Cambridge companion to Richard Rorty, which is, I think, in my view, sort of long overdue. And so I'm really excited about that project, and I'm thrilled to be working on that. Another sort of book project, still sort of in very early stages of research, is a book about anxiety and philosophy. And so, you know, very, very roughly, I want to sort of explore the extent to which anxiety, the experience of anxiety, kind of provokes reflection on some of philosophy's perennial questions about the nature of self, about freedom, about death. But I also want to suggest that a kind of that anxiety suggests, it doesn't only provoke reflection on those questions, it also suggests some answers to them. So I want to explore the idea that anxiety kind of helps to cobble together a philosophical worldview, so to speak, and to sort of defend that worldview as, you know, broadly speaking, correct. So I guess the thesis of the book, but as I say, it's still sort of very early stages, is that anxiety kind of yields a certain kind of philosophical wisdom. Kierkegaard famously said that anxiety is our best teacher. He also referred to anxious suffering as a school. So I guess what I'm wanting to do is kind of I want to explore the extent to which, you know, Kierkegaard might be right about that. But as I say, this is still in very early stages of reading and research. So there's a long way to go on that one.
Keep an eye out both of those projects, the Rorty project and the anxiety book, both sound very interesting to me. So, David, I want to thank you for your time today.
Well, thank you so much for having me on your program, Bob.
It's been great. And thank you, listeners, for joining us for our discussion. Remember, we were talking with David Rondeau. His book is titled Pragmatist Egalitarianism, and it's just been published by Oxford University Press. Thank you for listening, and bye for now.